Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books here on 90.7 KPFK FM. On today's show, poet Amy Uematsu comes to talk to us about poetry, of all things. Jerry Stahl has stopped by the studio again, this time to tell us why we should be familiar with Hubert Selby's The Room. The author Catherine Taylor is here to tell us about Eve Babbitt, a Los Angeles author she thinks we should all be reading. BJ Novak was here again last week, you won't be surprised to find out, but this is interesting. He actually didn't make it into the studio because he got stuck in his car. We had to call AAA, they got him out, but by the time that happened, we were done. He has kindly agreed to come back this week. He made me promise not to talk about that, but I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Joining me today are my usual colleagues, Tom Lutz, just out on parole. He is a professor, founding editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, general man about town. And Lori Weiner, she's an editrix, she's a journalist. Of course, she's an expert on Oscar Hammerstein, but you already know that. Welcome, Lori. Peter Lefcourt is with us today. He's a novelist, a playwright, an Emmy-winning television writer, a screenwriter. Peter, your new book is called Purgatory Gardens. And in looking over the titles, I'm thinking particularly of Die and I, which is about a guy who becomes obsessed with Princess Diana, and The Dreyfus Affair, which is about a gay baseball player written some years ago. You're a very zeitgeisty writer, and I'm wondering where Purgatory Gardens fits into that notion of your work.
I like zeitgeisty. That's kind of nice. Purgatory Gardens, I set out to write a book to disprove the famous F. Scott Fitzgerald maxim that there are no second acts in American lives. It's a story about three people who kind of wash up in Palm Springs for devious and diverse reasons. An ex-mafioso in witness protection, a formerly corrupt finance minister of an African republic who gets out of Africa 24 hours before he would probably be executed, and an aging ingenue, an actress who has seen better days, who's trying to figure out how to get through the rest of her life. Each of these three characters thinks the other one has money, and none of them do. And it's a comedy about expectations and also how the past informs the present.
Now, the deposed African leader's character makes me think of your time in the Peace Corps, which I only found out about recently. You were in Togo in the early 1960s.
I was in the Republic of Togo. I answered the call when John F. Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you." And I was actually in Togo when Kennedy was assassinated. And I didn't know about it for 3 months.
Wow.
I was in the bush.
No kidding.
I was one of the few people on this planet who didn't know about it.
That's
for 3
amazing.
Months. But it was a great experience.
And how did you find out? I mean, were you still
eventually in the bush? I went down to the Peace Corps office in the Capitol and saw a picture of Lyndon Johnson over the desk.
My God.
And I said, "What is that clown doing up there?" And they said, "Oh, nobody told you." It was a very, very strange retroactive history.
Now, in your book, The 11 Karens, there's a Karen who is in Africa. Though this is, it's a small part of the book, and I'm wondering, with 2 years in Togo under your belt, how come you never wrote a Peace Corps novel?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that, Seth. Well, two things. As I said, one of the characters in Purgatory Gardens, though not a Togolese, is an African, and it gave me some familiarity with the terrain. In 11 Karens, I just decided, you know, it's a story, it's a highly fictitious story about 11 women in my life, all who happened to be named Karen. Full disclosure, there are only 3.5 Karens in my life, but I figured 3.5 Karens wasn't a good book title, so I went for 11 Karens, and did a little bit of exaggeration. Though my wife is still wondering, you know, about the other 7.5 Karens.
Well, what about the half Karen? Was she short, or was she just wasn't in your life that much?
Well, the half Karen was one that we didn't consummate. How's that? So she only gets a half a point.
I have no idea what that means. I want to ask you about your premises, because you're kind of, I think of you as kind of a premise king. When somebody asked David Mamet, you know, where he gets his ideas from, he said in his brain, and I'm not asking you that, but I'm wondering about the process of when you know it's a good premise. Like, does it hit you suddenly? Do you have to sit with it for a while to see, you know, whether you can mine it?
Well, it's always a bit perilous. You know, there's a famous adage by Georges Simenon, that obscenely prolific Belgian-French writer. He said that he wrote to find out what was going to happen. And often a book will begin with just a very, very simple idea. In the case of The Deal, I did have the parenthesis. I said, what would happen to a guy? Is it possible to tell the story of someone who wants to kill himself and wins an Academy Award within a year? In terms of Di and I actually wrote a television novel called The Women of Windsor. CBS sent me over to London, and I spent 2 weeks with the paparazzi who run around after the royal family, and I said, this is really an interesting premise. What if Callow, screenwriter from Hollywood, gets sent over to London to do a movie, another hatchet job on Princess Diana, and they meet and they fall in love?
Every writer has a website these days, but you're the only one I know who has a section called apologies. What's that doing there?
Well, I have a lot to apologize for.
You can do it here and now if you like.
Well, you know, I actually first met Bob Dylan when his name was Bob Zimmerman in Schenectady, New York in 1962, just before he became the star he was, and I thought he was absolutely awful. I remember saying to myself, God, this guy sings through his nose. He doesn't carry a tune. And we kind of hung out together after, because what else do you do in Schenectady, New York? You know, we smoked a couple of joints together and we kind of hung out. I fell asleep and I woke up in the morning and he was gone with my girlfriend, a kilo of marijuana and $40. So that was my introduction to Bob Dylan.
How did that not become a novel?
Really?
It should have. Anyway, I ran into him again and he apologized. He gave me back $400. The girlfriend he could keep.
Prior to Purgatory Gardens, you published a novel called An American Family. And it's an unusual publishing story. You wound up putting it out with Amazon. What was that experience like?
Amazon approached me and said, you have a backlist of books. We will put them all up on Amazon if you can get the rights back. And if you give us an exclusive electronic window for 1 year. So I thought about that, and once you give them an exclusive electronic window, you're basically foreclosing any ability to publish, because no one is going to publish without electronic rights. So I said to myself, okay, we're now living in the digital age. I myself read on a Kindle.
And they were going to turn, to be clear, they were going to turn your catalog all into ebooks.
Exactly, exactly. I was lucky to get 5 of the 7 novels at the time. I was able to get the rights reverted. And so I said, sure, let me do this. And as I did it, I had pangs of conscience. A lot of my friends who rightfully love bookstores said, you know what you're doing? You're joining the enemy. And I went through a lot of soul searching about this particular issue. And I came up with the conclusion that the important thing is that people read. If they're reading electronically and not going to bookstores, okay, I will regret bookstores, but it's more important that they read. But believe me, I paid a price. I mean, there are people who won't talk to me because they said, you know, how could you do this? And I guess if I had to do it again, I don't know what I would do. I made the decision at the time, and I'm glad that my books are now all up on Amazon. You know, maybe every month I'll sell 3 copies of Abbreviating Ernie, but it's 3 copies. And, you know, I'm past being in it for the money. You know, I made my money in television. I was very happy doing that. And so I just want people to read.
The new book is Purgatory Gardens. Peter Lefcourt, thanks for coming to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Peter.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM. Catherine Taylor is the author of Valley Fever. She has kindly consented to come back and tell us about an author we all should know a little better. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thanks for having me back. I'm going to speak a little bit about Eve Babbitts. She's a writer I discovered 2 or 3 years ago. She had a couple of books in the 70s that were big hits at the time and have disappeared, although the New York Review of Books will put out her first novel, Eve's Hollywood, this fall. I'm not going to speak about Eve's Hollywood too much, although it's an excellent novel. I'm going to speak about her second book, Slow Days, Fast Company. It's a book of connected stories, and it reads as a novel. Slow Days, Fast Company is kind of the distilled and honed version of Eve's Hollywood. It uses a lot of the same material, a lot of Eve's biographical material. I think she's a bit reclusive these days. She lives in Los Angeles and hasn't written anything for a long time, but her books from the 70s are these exquisite exercises in voice and structure. And I'm thrilled that the New York Review of Books has rediscovered her and is helping other people rediscover her. I sort of wish they had done Slow Days, Fast Company first. I think it's such a superior book to Eve's Hollywood. Not everyone's first book is their best necessarily. And I think she took the material from Eve's Hollywood and turned it into what is almost a perfect novel. And I'm a little obsessed with her.
Who would you liken her to?
Well, I want to say Joan Didion. It's so obvious to say Joan Didion, but really it's like she's Joan Didion and Renata Adler, although she's more lighthearted, I think, than Renata Adler.
Well,
and Joan
everyone,
Didion.
Everyone's more lighthearted than Renata Adler. You should go talk to her. I think she lives out here,
well,
right?
Well, I must say she lives about two blocks away from where I play tennis, and I decided I should leave my stalking there. I think she's hard to get a hold of. I read a profile with her in Vanity Fair. It may have come out in 2013. The writer had a really hard time getting a hold of her, but then, of course, gave you instructions essentially for how to stalk her and find her address in Los Angeles.
She was in that terrible car accident. And I remember when it happened because it was my friend Jessica Strand lived on the same block as Eve at that time.
Yes.
And she was severely burned, and a lot of people pitched in for her medical care. And then she became a little bit reclusive.
Yes.
And it is interesting, right, that her first brush with fame is as a model, right? She's the nude model playing chess with Marcel Duchamp.
She was an accidental model, right? She took that picture to get back at her, I think it was a boyfriend who was married, who was not inviting her to the parties she should have been invited to. And she took that picture as a form of revenge. I forget where I've read all of this stuff, but this is all stuff I've picked up while stalking Eve. I wonder if Eve hasn't taken herself seriously enough as a writer and really thinks of herself more as a muse, because when that car accident happened, if you look at her body of work, is when really things stopped. And I wonder if the loss of her physical beauty somehow, you know, contributed to the loss of her sense of self, and she wasn't able to create the way she had been. Even now, in the few interviews you can find of her, when she speaks about her work, she speaks about it in a funny way that it's almost like a hobby or a side job or something not to be taken seriously. And the originality in her work is to be taken seriously.
The subtitle of this book is interesting, right?
The subtitle is The World, the Flesh, and L.A. I'm not sure I would have picked up this book with that subtitle. It would have sounded like something I wasn't interested in. It was so heartily recommended to me by people whose opinions I respect that I had to pick it up. And they had said, you know, this is right up your alley. And it is. It's that the voice is that somewhere between like extremely funny and about to commit suicide.
And can we do a little bit of the gossip? I mean, right? Because she's, I don't know if this is the right metaphor,
sure.
But she's kind of like the female Warren Beatty, right?
Sure. Well, this is the thing about Eve is that I think that this is where she's sort of pinned her identity on the muse aspect of who she is.
Well, if you haven't seen the photo of her playing chess with Duchamp, you should take a look at it. It looks like she's winning, actually. So what's that?
She's definitely winning.
But she has, I mean, who has she been linked with? Steve Martin.
Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
Someone said, this is another thing I read when I was stalking Eve, but someone, I wish I could remember who it was, said, every young man has an Eve Babbitts in his life. Usually it's Eve Babbitts.
That's amazing.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Catherine Taylor, your book is Valley Fever. Thanks for talking to us about Eve Babbitts.
Thanks a lot.
Jerry Stahl is back in the studio, the author of OG Dad. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
There's an old book you want to tell us about.
There's an author that has been sort of relegated to the dust heap of literary history, except for those who are obsessed by him cultishly. I think Richard Price would count among one of those, is Hubert Selby, whose book, Last Exit to Brooklyn and Requiem for a Dream, and my favorite, possibly the darkest book ever written He wrote a book called The Room. His rule was, if you think it, it goes on the page. And it is possibly the hardest to get through, yet most rewarding book you will ever have the pleasure of enduring.
And did you know Selby? He was in
Los Angeles. I knew Selby quite well. He helped me out a lot when I was trying to get clean, and was kind of a mentor for many, many years. He looked at the manuscript for Permanent Midnight when I hadn't shown it to anybody, and gave it back to me with the advice that really changed me as a writer, if not as a man. He said, when you write about somebody you hate, write about them with love, which sounds corny, but when it comes from the biggest literary and personal badass, you know, a guy who kicked dope, strapped to a gurney in the West Hollywood jail, you listen.
And Cubby was what his friends called him.
Yes.
Right?
Cubby Sully, yeah.
Was a great teacher.
He taught at USC for years. Yeah.
Yeah.
He helped a lot of people.
And so did you ever take a workshop with him or a class with him, or you just became friends?
We're just friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
The book is The Room by Hubert Selby. It's available on Kindle. And thanks, Jerry Stahl, for coming back.
Really a great time. Thanks for having me.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM. We're joined by the poet Amy Uematsu, who has written a poem that I love called The Weight of Nothing. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You're gonna read a poem for us, I think, to get us started. Is that right?
Sure, I'll be happy to. This poem is from my third book, Stone Bow Prayer. And it's based on a poem by Jack Michelin where he begins every line with, I chose. So after you hear this, you're going to get some idea of what I'm about. Purple like iris. I chose Cisco Kid, Tonto, and men dressed in black. I cheered the loudest when the Indians attacked. I chose loners, despising cliques at every age, but secretly hoping one day I'd get picked. I chose revolution, not evolution. I carried the red book, Soul on Ice, quoted from Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I knew the meaning of dialectical materialism. Once, I held my husband hostage for having no opinion. Once, a lover who wronged me said, I take no prisoners. I took sides like a junkie until I could see they both cared about winning, no matter the cost. And when I chose to give up the battle, a voice inside me was still calling my name. I always chose the romantic ending, listened to torch songs long before I'd ever died from longing. I took my cues from the moon. I chose saxophone and cha-cha, sipped scotch on the rocks, lounged in the shade of June afternoon, slowly chewing the skin of a Japanese plum. I chose purple for my bridesmaids when the custom was pastel. I wanted the alchemy of two hearts, but kept ending up with just one. I chose, that's not fair, is my stubborn refrain. The sky would rise bluer than gorgeous just to jeer me on. I chose the wisdom of woman, mom over dad, even when she hurt him. All the mothers of soldiers that never come back, and the grandma who made my favorite rice balls, though she forgot to add wine to sweeten the vinegar. How much I've relied on the kindred blessings of goddess, witch, and crone. I chose stone over grass, fish over bear. Trusted hands that can make things grow from cotton, clay, and seed. I chose poetry because she spoke to me so lovingly, the way my whole world quieted to hear.
It's fantastic. And, you know, one of the other poems in that same volume called Inside,
mm-hmm.
which is very different from this in that it's a lot of very, very short lines. Right. Sometimes you use the long line, the kind of, I think of it as a right. Whitman Ginsberg mm-hmm. line, and sometimes the very kind of short line. And the short line poem is based on photographs from rural Japan.
Right.
And it seems like you were almost kind of channeling a Japanese poetic style at the same time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's very fair to say. It's interesting because I call them haiku-like, but they're not really haiku. I haven't gotten into the American haiku scene. But I also feel that some of the slimness and the sparsity has to do with my being a math teacher.
Yes.
And I think in math, you also try to really get things down to bare bones, but try to make it elegant.
You taught math for 30 years.
32 years.
32 years.
Los yeah. Angeles Unified Schools. Uh-huh. And somehow I survived.
and you were a math major in college?
Major at UCLA. Uh-huh. Yeah, English minor.
How do you go from being a math major to being a poet?
This is interesting. In my senior year at UCLA, I took my first Asian American studies class. And the Asian American, quote unquote, movement was beginning in around 1968. And so for this particular class, I had to write a term paper. So it's spring of 1969. I write a term paper called The Emergence of Yellow Power in America, very influenced by reading about Black Power.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going through a lot of personal turmoil and excitement, and I mean changes, major changes to my racial identity. So at the end of the term paper, I included three poems, and the poems seemed to be able to capture what an essay, of course, couldn't.
And in short, 3 years later, you're already publishing an anthology of Asian American writing.
Editing. And the reason I did that with my co-editors is that there was nothing, I mean, really nothing
Zero.
Available mm-hmm. for Asian American studies classes at the time. So we had, besides historical articles, we had a big section on identity that included poetry. That was the section mm-hmm. I was in charge of. We had interviews with various Asian American activists.
You said that you were going through a transformation with your identity in those years. Your parents had been interned.
Right. I was born in Pasadena.
Okay.
So my family is three generations in Southern California. So my grandparents, who are called Issei, that's mm-hmm. the first generation, they all settled down here and worked. And my parents were both, one was born in Montebello, and my mother was born in Pasadena also. And so the Uematsu branch, my dad's side, they were interned at Manzanar concentration camp. And my mother's side, the Pasadena area, they were sent to Gila Relocation Center or concentration camp in Arizona.
To what degree did that experience inform your childhood?
It did in a different kind of way because my parents were teenagers. So as teenagers, they figured out ways to enjoy themselves. So the first things I heard about camp were from the point of view of their memories of being teenagers and having a lot of fun and hanging out with kids.
Wow.
You know, it was a little different.
That's not part of the history that you usually hear, yeah.
Right. And on top of that, I don't think the Issei spoke that much about the camps. They just went on with their lives afterwards and tried to rebuild their lives. We were raised in a very super Americanized, assimilationist fashion. And that could have been a result of my parents trying to make us as American as possible after that camp experience. They didn't attempt to teach us any Japanese. They were bilingual, but they never spoke Japanese at home.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And some of the other Sansei I know, Sansei being third generation Japanese Americans, they were sent to Japanese school or they got Japanese dance lessons, things like that. We didn't have any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read us one more poem?
Yeah. I hope you don't mind. This is kind of an angry poem.
I love angry poems.
We love anger.
Go for it.
This piece is based on my seeing a picture by Roger Shimamura. And his art is really very much protesting Japanese-American stereotypes. And in this picture, it looks like mugshots of 83 Japanese-looking guys in the real stereotypical way, mm-hmm. you know, with the glasses and the buck teeth. I wrote this piece after I saw Roger's picture, and I call it Mugsheet. This is no Buttercup's sappy sun poem, no yellow happy faces to paste all over my room. I still pay attention to yellow light warnings, my young life unfolding along that yellow peril trail. Just like you, Roger, always the foreigner, the ugly Jap. Strange how ugly can still mean invisible. The slitty-eyed general, the snake with thick horn-rimmed glasses, the eunuch commie spy Charlie Chan and Fu Manchu are just the Jekyll and Hyde of the same yellow-bellied alien. And piss yellow terror can be seen in the eyes of that white trucker in Redwood City who tells me there's nothing worse than a pregnant Jap. But at least he's better than the yellow fetish freaks who can't get enough of us sexy geisha and China girls, no matter if we're from Vietnam, Korea, or San Francisco. We Lotus Lovelies are all the same. Just listen to that blue-eyed boyfriend who swears I look like Hong Kong-born Kathy, though she's 5 inches taller, with eyes pointing up and mine slanting down. Yellow lurks in hordes like the 83 of us dirty Japs mugging for the camera. But sure is the law, which put Roger and Grandpa and Auntie Alice in camp. I'll be ready the next time we're misnamed the enemy. Yes, the first to line up with my fellow Genghis and Samurai invaders. Never again, we vow, raising our yellow devil fists.
Amy Uematsu, thank you for visiting us at the LARB Radio Hour. Those poems were very, very powerful.
Thank you.
That's our show for this week. Our thanks to Amy Uematsu, Catherine Taylor. Our thanks to Jerry Stahl. Thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin. Our production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano. The indefatigable Sid Biggs, who came in even though he had a cold this week. We apologize once again for BJ Novak not being on, if you were sticking around to hear him. But BJ, he's a little miffed, of course, but he has agreed reluctantly, and I think we're really going to try to get him on next week, but he said he'll come back. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. You've been listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK-FM. And before I sign off, I want to remind you once again, we are up to 11 ratings on iTunes. We could use some more. We could use about 1,000 more, actually. Lori,
please do
the ratings pitch.
Please.
Oh, that was so abject. It was perfect. Do it, but with more emotion.